Support for WPR comes from Lawrence University in Appleton, a national liberal arts college and conservatory, offering an engaging global education with funding for internships, research, study abroad, and more. Lawrence.edu.
Support for WPR comes from Isthmus Partners, an asset management firm providing comprehensive financial planning and tailored investment solutions for long-term growth and capital preservation. More at isthmuspartnersllc.com.
Our next guest takes a deep look at political ambition in the United States, what separates the people from their elected representatives, why we're suspicious of people with political ambition, and how we're not living up to our role as citizens.
Jeffrey Becker is with us now. He's Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of the Pacific. His new book is called Ambition in America, Political Power and the Collapse of Citizenship. Jeffrey, welcome to the show.
Thank you for inviting me on your show, Rob.
So your book is about citizens and the people who want to represent them. Let's start with the citizens. You write, I'm quoting here, "Amid the celebration of individual ambition, Americans seem to have lost the ambition to be citizens." And I love that phrase, the ambition to be citizens. What would that look like? What is the ambition to be a citizen?
Well, what I was struck by was the way in which we often talk about how citizens do not participate in American politics, or alternatively, how elected officials might abuse their power. But what we miss is that in-between concept of people actually participating in daily life, people participating by running for elected office, and we don't really encourage political ambition in ways that support democracy. Americans will openly praise people with ambition in private life. We celebrate people as celebrities, entrepreneurs, but we don't trust people who show ambition in public life. We do encourage citizens to vote, but we do not train, nor do we encourage citizens to run for political office. And as I've quoted another person, Joseph Schlesinger, saying, a political system unable to kindle ambitions for office is in as much danger of breaking down as one unable to restrain ambitions.
Did we lose that kind of positive citizen ambition along the way somewhere, or did we never really develop it in the first place?
I think it comes in ebbs and flows. I think there have been moments where citizens have tried to organize collectively, where what it meant to participate locally means more than what we have now. And I write about this in talking about periods in American history where political ambition was of citizens was thwarted, where citizens organize themselves to participate in politics, to take control of a civic life that they thought they were losing control of, but they ended up ultimately undermining themselves. And so it's a story in this book where what we have is we've celebrated individuals. We praise that individual who wants to make a difference, but we don't really cultivate a way of people working together or working collectively. Public office has to be worthy of people's ambitions. And when you ask people today, do you want to run for public office? Often they don't want to. They look at the scrutiny a candidate goes through, and that's not something a lot of people want. So it's a complex story, and I think the story that I'm trying to tell is a way in which that what gives people dignity has departed less and less, or it's moved away from public life.
And yeah, it's in that phrase I quoted, the celebration of individual ambition. So I'll represent the citizen here. I'm more interested in personal fulfillment, personal, maybe financial success, instead of maybe at the expense of embracing the duties of a citizen.
Well, that's precisely what we've had. We have people who celebrate personal wealth, and they see personal wealth as a way of satisfaction. It's a way in which things matter. Democratic life is hard. You get a tangible reward when you work for a job that pays you well. When you spend a lot of time working on legislation or working collectively with others, you don't always get what you want. You don't always get to guarantee the outcome. And I think that's part of the problem, is that we have a celebration of individuals that don't make room for the contributions or smaller contributions of people at the local level, or at least what we reward people for is that individual celebrity. We have a lot of people who want to be famous, but we don't have a lot of people who really want to participate in the sort of the nuts and bolts workings of daily life.
And we can point toward a lot of political movements where people get involved, but based on what you're talking about, I wonder, is there a negative way to be involved in politics? I'm active now only because I see my individual rights being infringed on, as opposed to maybe a positive way of being involved. I'm active because I want to get together with fellow citizens and shape the future of the country.
Yes, I think there is. I have a fear that we may be coming to a point where an elected official who is only concerned about his or her career puts their own celebrity above a larger good, the good of the country. I think that the healthy ambition that I argue for is an ambition that embraces a certain degree of thanklessness, a certain degree that you make your contribution, but you don't expect to be celebrated for it. You don't expect to be highly compensated for it, at least financially. And I think that's something that tears at the larger fabric of what we reward in American politics. We have candidates who forward themselves for elected office, but they haven't really spent that time working in their local communities. Not all, some have, but we have that situation where, you know, candidates put themselves up because they have the money to run for office, not because they've been actively involved in communities at the local, state, county, or regional level.
Well, given, as you've said, that we as citizens are suspicious of politics, distrust it, don't want to do the dirty work of getting directly involved in running for office, who does that leave? Is it in that situation? Is it only people interested in self-aggrandizement who are actually going to run for office? Is it that bad?
Well, I'm not sure it's quite that bad yet, but I look at what gets rewarded and the kinds of people who want that kind of recognition, and the question comes up, are these the people who are best qualified to govern? We increasingly see billionaires whose drive we admire putting themselves up as qualified candidates to be governors, qualified candidates to be senators, and yet it's not clear that the skills that lead somebody to be incredibly successful in business translate into the skills needed to govern. We don't necessarily like the imperious quality of somebody who is a corporate CEO who can make that quick decision. And a Democratic leader is somebody who has to forge compromises. So what we have are people who have made their success by not necessarily compromising. I look at a figure like Steve Jobs, talented CEO, but I'm not sure I want somebody like that as my governor.
Again, based on what you've said so far, though, if we don't trust politics or the politicians we see, there's a lot of appeal in somebody who we can see as an outsider. And in fact, a lot of people very deliberately try to run as outsiders outside of Washington, untainted by the political process.
Yes, that is precisely the appeal. And I think one of the cautions I have is that somebody like that appears as though they can solve all your problems. You could just turn your problems on to that person. I think a lot of people look at politicians this way as saviors from politics. And that, I think, teaches a very dangerous lesson about politics, which is politics is really about day-to-day interaction with the people you share a life with. And then when somebody comes in and says, we can solve all these problems, they sort of offer that easy solution, that there's some kind of simple solution to what are often difficult and intractable problems. We might not trust these politicians because they are making promises that couldn't possibly be fulfilled. I think that's increasingly what we're seeing as people who run for office by running against office. And that teaches us the lesson that, well, politics is a problem. It's not a way of life. It's something that needs to be resolved or solved or dispensed with.
Do you see more and more compromise, doing the dirty work, sometimes sacrificing principles to get something done? as being increasingly hard to do for politicians because of the punishment they might get from the citizens who elect them.
Yes. That is increasingly what we're seeing, is that for a candidate who is unwilling to appeal to whatever is popular for his or her constituency, primary constituency, they're increasingly afraid to cross the aisle. We repeatedly see candidates punished for compromising principles. And in a way, this is one of the legacies of what we've had in the 20th century. The more and more people demand their way, the way they want, what their outcome is as they see it, the less willing they are to compromise with people they see as on the other side of the aisle or even immoral. And part of what I address is how that dynamic of seeing the people you disagree with as immoral or even evil gets in the way of trying to compromise for democratic politics.
We're talking with Jeffrey Becker. He's the author of the book Ambition in America, talking about citizens, political representatives, and the divide, maybe growing divide, between them.
And you can join the conversation. Are you suspicious of people with political ambition? Would you run for elected office? If you are in office or have run for office, what motivated you? And why do you think we're skeptical when it comes to politicians? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email talk@wpr.org. We continue our conversation with Jeffrey Becker, author of Ambition in America, Political Power and the Collapse of Citizenship.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you have a blanket distrust for politicians and elected officials? If not, why do you think a lot of people do? Would you run for office? Have you run for office? What motivated you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email talk@wpr.org. Jeffrey, you mentioned that citizenship, political participation can ebb and flow. Do you worry, though, that we might move past some kind of breaking point that ultimately threatens representative government in our country?
Well, that's what I fear we're at right now. I fear we're at a point where many citizens look at the electoral arena and say, I don't want to be a part of it, or I don't have anything to contribute. I'm not a millionaire. I'm not a billionaire. It's easier just to focus on my private life. And that's the fear I have, is that we may be coming to a point where our elected officials lose contact with the kind of lives most of us live. Most of these officials that people don't trust have a disconnect with their with the people they represent. And I think that's part of the problem that I'm trying to describe, is a culture of celebrity allows us to put any values we want on these candidates, and those values might not be the ones we share, or they might not be the ones that the community in which we live shares. And that disconnect, I think, is a threat to democracy in the American Republic right now.
So one way of thinking about it is people go into politics for good reasons, but because the system of compromise and maybe corruption is inherently bad, it taints them. It makes them into bad people no matter where they started. Is there something to that?
Well, that's I think, one of the symptoms of a culture where we expect people to just realize our perfect values. And I think if we're training citizens to realize that compromise is part of the democratic process, that's not what we learn. What we learn is, I want my way, I want my rights, I want everything the way I want it. That focus on the self, I think, leads people to not want to compromise or not see compromise as a good thing, that you have to compromise with people you live with. You have to compromise with people in whom you share a town, you share a community, you work with. And I think we're moving away from a culture where people see themselves as wanting to compromise, being willing to compromise, or respecting people who actually craft, at the legislative level, compromises across two different parties.
We'll go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. We've got Kurt on the line in Plover. Kurt, hi.
Hi, and thanks for taking my call. I don't take part in the democratic process simply because I believe anybody who wants to run for office should be disqualified due to insanity.
Kurt, Kurt, thanks for the call. I mean, that's maybe not an uncommon thought. Who would want to subject themselves to that process and then do the work once they're there?
Well, I like Kurt's point because that's exactly where many Americans see themselves. The people who want to run for office are not people many of us would want to govern us. And I think a lot of that comes from, well, what are those traits of ambition? If we never are teaching people how to run for office, traits of ambition that we respect, then I think Kurt describes where many of us are. If you want to run for office, I instantly don't trust you. You seem like somebody who wants something from me and not somebody who I see as part of my culture, somebody who represents me or my values, which I think is part of the problem.
Okay, so Jeffrey, how do we get all those other people to take the idea of running for office seriously?
Well, the solution that I offer up is that a revision political parties that actually link our elected officials, that linked public office with the daily lives of citizens, offers one possibility. If you are participating in public life, if you're participating in local governments, if candidates have to work their way up through local offices as opposed to, entering that process at the senatorial level, at the presidential level, you may have more of a sense of connection between the candidates who are actually running for office and the communities of which they come. Historically, people, at least in ancient Athens, were elected office by lottery. I don't think we can go back that way, but there needs to be a sense that each of us has an obligation to participate in public life or at least see public questions as something that we ought to weigh in on.
We're talking to Jeffrey Becker. His new book is Ambition in America, Political Power and the Collapse of Citizenship. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you trust people who run for office? Would you run for office yourself? Do you think there's something about our political process that is inherently corrupting? What would you do to fix it? 800-642-1234 is the number, or you can email talk@WPR.org. And following up that last point you made, Jeffrey, it sounds like a lot of the core problem that you've talked about with celebrity politicians, outsider politicians, is a lack of connection, both to the communities they in theory serve, but also to other politicians, other elites that they might have to compromise with.
Yes, I think that part of what we have breaking down is a sense that the lives we lead are connected to our political system. We look at people on the national stage and we don't really know them. They don't seem as though people that espouse values that we recognize, or that they don't live lives that most of us can know. I mean, I live in California and I know who Scott Walker is. Is that a function of me growing up with Scott Walker? No, I've never met the man. I don't know the community from which he comes. But there are these elected officials who take on these national profiles. Anybody can now post their own material on the internet and develop a national following. But is that a following connected to where they live their lives, connected to the community physically, geographically, where they live? And I think it's that lack of connection connected with this kind of celebrity culture that creates this sort of disconnect. It creates a culture of celebrity that leaves little room for the average citizen to meaningfully contribute to public life.
Go back to our callers now. We've got Melinda on the line in Trempealeau. Melinda, hi.
Hi. I was just on to say I had run for office before at Coroner, and it's really strange to be running for an office like that. You wouldn't think you'd have to run for coroner. And then besides, you have to run Republican or Democrat or independent or whatever, and that should not be a political office, and especially because it goes nowhere.
And did you have to be a politician and go door to door and everything else a candidate for a city council might do?
Oh, yeah. Parades. You hold the kissing the baby thing, the handing the pamphlets up, the whole work, yeah.
All right, Melinda, thanks for the call. Maybe not coroner, Jeffrey, but do we need to put more weight on our local offices? to get people in at that level?
I like the fact that Melinda really introduces that local, what a local campaign is like. It's going door to door, meeting people. And that, my guess is that the people who supported Melinda got to know Melinda. I don't know Melinda, but I imagine that the people who were supporting her for that office had a better sense of who she was. And I think that you wouldn't get the kinds of criticisms of a local official like that than you get of national officials. Now imagine hypothetically that if Melinda works her way up, regional offices, state offices, carefully, the longer she's in politics, the more people know who she is, where she comes from, what she stands for, and the less mistrust there might be for a candidate like that. I think that a political party that tries to cultivate local candidates like that, that tries to base its recruitment efforts on getting local candidates like that, has a stronger connection to the local communities, has a stronger connection to practices of daily democracy.
Linda, thanks for the call. We'll go to Dorothy in Milwaukee now. Dorothy, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
Well, I was on the county board in Milwaukee County for 20 years, and I was county treasurer for 5 after that. My experience was that, again, like Melinda, I went door to door, and I had already a base in the community. I was about 30, I think, when I first ran, and I already had a base in the community, so I had a whole slew of volunteers that were willing to help, and that does make a tremendous difference because we had worked on community issues together. They knew me. They knew like what my orientation was towards the community and towards politics. And going door to door was just, it was a wonderful experience. I loved it. But I got out of politics. I would have stayed in longer, but I got out of it because I was sick and tired of being verbally abused. I was really sick and tired of the incivility from my colleagues, because that's kind of when I began to notice. It was in the late 1990s.
Dorothy, thank you for the call. Jeffrey, just 30 seconds left. Can we make politics a little nicer to keep people in it?
I think Dorothy really highlights what the challenge is. You get people who want to run. They've got a clear base of support. But when they start to encounter really virulent criticism, that people no longer want to run. So what does that leave us with? People who are ambitious enough to withstand that kind of criticism. And those kinds of people might not be the best kinds of people to govern in a democratic republic.
We'll leave it there for now. Jeffrey, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Rob.
That's Jeffrey Becker. He's Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of the Pacific. His new book is Ambition in America, Political Power, and the Collapse of Citizenship. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. My co-host, Veronica Rickert, will be back on the air with me tomorrow. Coming up on Central Time, a guest says income inequality isn't just an abstract concept. It affects our lives in ways we don't always see. First, in honor of Labor Day, we'll talk about the hardest working cities in the United States. According to calculations made by the website sparefoot.com, Madison is the second hardest working city in the country, with Milwaukee coming in at number 8. Here to talk about how they came up with these rankings, we have John Egan. He's editor-in-chief of sparefoot.com. John, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Rob. How are you?
Well, I'm good. Well, before we get to the how you did this, why? Why did you want to find out who is working the hardest in the country?
Well, in your lead-in, I think you mentioned it, we really wanted to shine a light on the hardest working towns in America in honor of Labor Day. And we were curious to see which towns rose to the top. And obviously, two cities in Wisconsin are very high on the list.
Now, there are probably a lot of ways you could have tried to measure this. What did you use? What did you look at?
Well, the data we looked at came from the Census Bureau and the Bureau of Labor Statistics, and a lot of it revolves around various elements of people's work week. For instance, hours worked plus commuting time, and how many people hold down more than one job. things like that that were good barometers for how much work people put in on a daily and weekly, monthly and yearly basis.
So do you think you're measuring how gung-ho we are to work here in Wisconsin and other places around the country, or is it partly a measure of how successful local economies are that make people able to work more hours?
Well, I think it's a combination of the two. I don't know that in this list you could necessarily separate the two. Mm. Certainly, if you look at the entirety of our list, there were 7 out of the 12 communities that we singled out are all in the Midwest. And I think the Midwest is known for having a very strong work ethic.
Now, Minneapolis pulled off the number one spot. Why is that?
Well, they edged out everybody else in things like the number of hours worked per capita was very high. All across the board, they did well in the categories that we measured, whether it was hours worked or number of jobs held down, that sort of thing. They didn't necessarily peak out at number one on everything, but they were very strong in all the categories we measured.
Well, let's get to our Wisconsin representation here. What got the capital city, Madison, so high on the list? I know traditionally Madison, or at least the county, has low unemployment. Would that be a big driver here?
Yeah, it sounds like it is. The percentage of people who don't work at all in Madison is lower there than anywhere else in the 100 biggest metro areas in the U.S. that we looked at. And on top of that, the total number of hours worked per capita is higher in Madison than anywhere else among the 100 metro areas we looked at. So very high marks on both those categories pushed Madison up to the number two spot.
And then in Milwaukee, it's known for having somewhat higher unemployment. It's a Midwestern urban area. A lot of those types of cities are, there's higher unemployment. Yet, Milwaukee made it to number 8 on the list of hardest working cities. What brought them into the top 10?
Well, there wasn't any certain area where Milwaukee really stood out, although the residents there are quite likely to hold down more than one job, so that helped contribute to the number 8 ranking. But all across the board, Milwaukee had solid marks, and it's obviously no accident that President Obama chose Milwaukee to speak on Labor Day.
Were you surprised by any of the cities that made it to the top of your list?
I really wasn't. I wasn't because so many of them are in the Midwest. I grew up in the Midwest, so I know about the work ethic, and I think that's an underpinning for all of the communities that were on the list, that there's a strong work ethic in each one of those places.
Well, part of the fun of a list like this is it seems like it could be a conversation starter, maybe a good-natured argument starter. Are you hearing a lot of backtalk from people saying, hey, what about my city? Where are we on the list?
I haven't seen that yet, but those things do tend to happen, as you noted, when lists like this come out. You know, there are different ways that you can slice and dice data. We're very confident that the way we looked at the data is a valid way of looking at the hardest working towns in America.
Well, one thing you didn't include in this is something that would be harder to measure, the intangibles, ideas of work ethic or gumption or grit or whatever you want to call it. Do you think that, even though you can't really put a number on it, do you think that might be behind some of the ratings you were able to measure?
Yeah, I do, especially when you're talking about the number of hours worked per capita and the willingness to hold down more than one job. There's something there that drives people to want to work harder. And as you said, it may not be easily measured just on that specific thing that, you know, you have a stronger work ethic. But that would underlie some of the strong statistics that were present in Madison and Milwaukee.
Now, one interesting one, you mentioned most of the cities were in the Midwest. One that clearly isn't is Honolulu, Hawaii, number 11 on the list. Now, I've got an observer bias here. All I hear about with Hawaii, of course, is people from the Midwest who escape the winter from time to time and go on vacation there. What put Honolulu on this hardworking list?
Well, in general, I would say that there is a strong work ethic there as well. And if you look at the number of jobs there that are tied to tourism and how hard people in that industry in general tend to work, it didn't surprise me at all that Honolulu was on the list because, the people who clean your rooms and serve your food and all that stuff, I mean, hats off to them. They put in a long day every day when they're doing work like that.
Now, as you take these numbers, you've got the top 12 list. Are there lessons that you think we can learn from looking at which cities make it into this hardworking dozen list?
Well, I think anybody who's not on this list could look at it and say, gee, what's Madison doing? What's Milwaukee doing that maybe we could incorporate into our workforce in wherever we are? But a lot of that is kind of built into the DNA of the community, so I don't know that you can necessarily take a gigantic lesson and then apply it to your own community, but maybe there are programs in Madison and Milwaukee that are promoting workforce involvement, workforce engagement, that are helping lift the hardworking attitude of both of those communities.
All right. And as you said at the outset, this was kind of a tribute for Labor Day. What any Labor Day thoughts to share with us?
Well, I think people need to take their hats off to all the communities that made this list, whether it's Madison, Milwaukee, Honolulu, Denver, Boston, and the other communities that are on the list. That being said, I think in general, America is known as a very hardworking nation, and anybody who's not on this list shouldn't take it as a slight against them. It's just some communities like Madison, Milwaukee are really at the pinnacle of that hardworking ethic that is present in a lot of these communities.
All right, we'll leave it there for now, John. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. Take care.
That's John Egan. He's editor-in-chief of sparefoot.com. Maybe interested in hearing from you on these issues. Do you think that Wisconsin, maybe the Midwest in general, is particularly hardworking, has a work ethic different than the rest of the country? You can let us know at the Central Time Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Or maybe give a call, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Well, as we just heard, two of Wisconsin's biggest cities, Wisconsin's two biggest cities, made this national list of the hardest working cities in the United States, looking at how much people work, how many jobs they have, employed versus unemployed, that sort of thing. Now we want to throw things over to you. Do you think that Wisconsin has a strong work ethic, that we're a particularly hard-working state, or the Midwest, for that matter? 800-642-1234. And this study, now, this was cities of a certain size, didn't take into account smaller communities as well, rural areas. What is the work ethic like where you are? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234. Or send an email, talk@WPR.org. And do you see work ethics getting better, worse, over the years from generation to generation? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. We'll go to Kenneth in Janesville to start us off. Ken, hi.
Hello. What it is an indication of a lot of poor-paying jobs that requires you to really a race on the treadmill to keep up, I mean, to survive.
Gotcha. Thanks a lot for the call, Ken. And that's one thing that this, I wouldn't even call it a study, this top 12 list didn't look at was how much these jobs pay. So that definitely is a factor outside of it, but might be part of what's behind that. Thanks a lot for the call, Ken. You can join in at 800-642-1234. I'll go now to Brett with us in Jefferson County. Brett, hi.
Hey, Rob, great topic on Labor Day. But yeah, PolitiFact Wisconsin just ranked Wisconsin as having the lowest income growth in the Midwest and 44th lowest in the nation since Governor Walker was elected. So, you know, people are having to work two and three jobs here just to keep up, you know, and survive. So I'm not sure this list is really a good thing or really captured the fact that we're just struggling economically.
Brett, thanks a lot for the call. Yeah, I think the list was in some ways value neutral. I mean, they looked at it as a positive, the hardest working phrasing. But on the other hand, there are a lot of factors that didn't necessarily show up in what they looked at. Thanks a lot for the call, Brett. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is there such a thing as a Wisconsin work ethic, a Midwestern work ethic? What do you think about our attitudes toward labor work, and do we value those things enough as we observe Labor Day today? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. We've got Lori on the line in Berlin. Lori, hi.
Hi. Actually, I'm from Oshkosh, but I started working in Berlin about a year and a half ago. Berlin, Wisconsin is a population of about 5,000 people. And before that, I worked here in Oshkosh, which is relatively small also, about 66,000-67,000. And I went from one healthcare job to another healthcare job. The one that it was at in Oshkosh was about, I spent about 15, 16 years there, and I took it as, well, this is the way things are, when I noticed that people just really weren't connected to what they were doing. They really, you know, they figured they were at this job for a while and they were going to move on, and that's just life. So I thought, well, that's the work ethic that we see now. When I moved to the rural healthcare job, I could not believe the difference. I told my boss this recently. I said, I really never want to leave this because I've never seen such dedicated people.
Huh.
I don't know if it comes from just being in a farming community, or my actual belief is that they have accountability because they all know each other. Everybody knows everybody. The people who cook in the kitchen recognize that other people know that they're the ones that are cooking that day, and there's a special care that they put into it because they know that they're accountable. And I think, you know, when you have a small community and the mom is working there and the sister is working there, they have accountability for family reasons. I go over and over it in my head trying to figure out why there was such a difference moving from a larger area to a smaller area and seeing such good workers. But in all, I've always felt the Midwest did have a better work ethic. When I saw what my sister had in Florida or what my sister had in South Carolina, I recognize that we're very lucky in the Midwest. We have people who care about their jobs. Mm-hmm. And I'll hang up and
Lori,
listen online.
Thank you so much. Very interesting observations there. Oh, I wonder what our other listeners think. Do you agree? Maybe that personal connection you have in a small town, if you're falling on the job, everybody knows about it? 800-642-1234 is the number. We've got Teresa on the line in Green Bay now. Teresa, hi.
Hello. I have lived in Hawaii, Arizona, Nevada, Wisconsin, and I think it's more along the lines of the type of job you have versus the actual area that you're living in, because I don't really see a difference in any of the different states that I've lived in, but I have seen a difference in the different industries I've worked in.
So is there an industry that you feel like has a stronger work ethic than another?
The industry that cares for people.
Hmm. Interesting. Are you a healthcare worker?
Well, I'm working for a DME provider, but I have also done child care. I've worked with children a lot. I've also done banking in different states and in different capacities. And it's sad to say, the banking doesn't hold a candle to the work ethic of those who care for people.
Oh, very interesting. Thank you so much for sharing those thoughts, Teresa. I really appreciate it. We'll go now to Susan in Dane County. Susan, hi.
Hello. I believe that we should be able to make enough money to sustain ourselves with one job. We shouldn't need to have more than one job. And I think that using markers of more than one job throw in disparity and lack of quality of life.
Interesting. Thank you so much, Susan, for sharing that. I kind of wondered that, too. It is the top 12 list we were looking at did mix a diverse array of rationale there. So that it could be that some people are just forced to work two jobs. Thanks a lot for the call, Susan. Go now to Eva in Chicago, Illinois. Eva, hi.
Hi.
What do you think of this? Yeah, go for it.
Well, what's happened is a really good high school graduation rate, and kudos to Wisconsin for getting the job done with their children. I'm from Chicago, and we have, I think, a great work ethic, but we you know, education correlates to employment, so we do have a lot of kids that maybe don't get as much opportunity early as could later.
Gotcha. You know, we're kind of losing you, Eva. Thanks. I think I got some of the gist there. People are hardworking there, but the opportunity and the educational opportunity you're not seeing as being there. Thanks for the call. Following up on our initial conversation, ranking the cities by how hardworking they are around the country. Wisconsin's two biggest cities, Madison and Milwaukee, both on that list, number 2 and 8, respectively. Taking your thoughts on Wisconsin's work ethic, labor in general, and do we value labor enough? 800-642-1234. We go now to Christine in Madison. Christine, hi.
Hi. I live in Wisconsin and work in Wisconsin now, and I have worked and lived in the South, specifically Tennessee, and the work ethic in the Midwest is much stronger. The attitude of how people conduct themselves and just how hard people are willing to dedicate themselves to work in Wisconsin is much, much different than what I experienced when I was down south.
Are you happier to be working in this kind of environment then, Christine?
Yes, I am, except for when we have our blizzards and all of our snow. Then I wish I was back in Tennessee.
Yeah, Tennessee has its charms then when you're trying to dig out. Thank you so much, Christine. I'll go now to Ron with us in Mauston. Ron, hi.
Yeah, good afternoon. I just want to make a general point about labor in America. You know, we remember a time years ago when all labor was, you know, respected at least. I wonder what happened where the truck driver, the farm laborer, the carpenter is kind of debased and, you know, nobody really wants to do these jobs anymore, but yet they're so vital to our country. But yet the wealthy, you know, industrialists and so forth and bankers and lawyers, they're revered. So I don't know. What do you think happened in the decades?
Ron, I don't have an answer for you, but thank you so much. Very, very interesting observations as we mark Labor Day. Time for one more call. We've got Dan on the line in Green Bay. Dan, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to bring up, Dan?
Well, I think that most of the situations being brought on by different things forcing businesses to reduce the hours that they can give employees. You know, mandates in healthcare is one of them that specifically I think of. There are ways to go about it that they could still give people a full-time job. They should incentivize businesses to give people full-time jobs, not reduce their ability to give them full-time jobs. And I think that's a big problem.
Dan, thanks a lot for call. Thanks to all of you for your calls on this Labor Day, talking about hard work, the work ethic in Wisconsin, the Midwest, and beyond.